You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio from South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, January 30th, 2018. Monroe County Community School Corporation School Board submitted a letter to the Indiana Legislature condemning the proposed state takeover of Gary and Muncie School Corporations. We'll hear from the author of the letter, MCCSC Board Member Kathy Fuentes-Rauer, later in the program on today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the first episode in our new series, The Bicentennial Journal, exploring 200 years of Bloomington and Monroe County history. That's coming up later in the program, but first, your daily headlines.
The city of Bloomington is working to make travel on West Bloomfield Road easier for pedestrians and cyclists. The city began installing a multi-use path on the north side of the road last year. To continue the project, engineer Neil Copper says the city needs to acquire right-of-way for 8 land parcels between Patterson Street and Landmark Avenue. Copper told the Board of Public Works on January 23rd, the city's engineering contract with WSP USA will also have to be amended. All but 2 of the parcel acquisitions are needed to complete improvements at the intersection of Bloomfield and Patterson. Copper says some of the right-of-way acquisitions are temporary. The project also calls for the installation of traffic signals at both intersections. Construction is expected to continue into 2019. The board approved the acquisitions and contract extensions. Later in the meeting, Public Works Director Adam Wason discussed the city's winter de-icing efforts with board member Dana Palazzo. He said the city had used more salt this year last weekend, than it had in all of last year. Wason also squelched a rumor the city had run out of de-icing salt. In fact, the city had a surplus of salt left over from last year. Board Vice President Kelly Boatman asked Wason whether the city has looked into more environmentally friendly options. He says the major issue is the capital investment needed to move away from a salt product. According to Wason, the city uses a Cargill product that is EPA approved.
Among the legislation up for a vote today in Indianapolis is a payday lending bill. On paper, House Bill 1319 would lower the interest rates for some payday loans in the state. But consumer advocacy organizations say the legislation adds new kinds of financial products that could be more dangerous for working-class Hoosiers. The Indiana Institute for Working Families, Jessica Fraser, says current payday lending products have exorbitant interest rates, but with a short payback period. Speaking from the House floor this afternoon, Fraser says House Bill 1319 would pose a greater danger to low-income families than current payday lending practices.
And this new bill is an expansion that allows them to loan more money for 12 months at about 222%, up to 222% APR. The exact APR depends on the terms of each individual loan. But it's not a replacement or a reform of the current payday product. It is a new product that they're adding on top of the current payday product. So they'll be able to do both. And the other key piece that's different, and this is where it's the big concern, now you can make a lot less and be eligible to take out a lot more. So whereas if you make $15,000 or so a year with the payday product, you're only going to be eligible for a few hundred bucks. With this new product, you can make $15,000 and be eligible for almost $1,500. And that's just way too much debt for someone who's very, very low income to be able to take out.
Indiana Coalition for Human Services President Emily Bryant echoed Fraser's statement on House Bill 1319.
The vote on third reading is expected when the Indiana House comes back from recess. And we expect it to be a close vote. The Indiana Coalition for Human Services is opposed to the language in House Bill 1319 because it have an adverse impact on the clients of many of our members, 25 human services organizations. Some are direct service and some represent direct service agencies. Our concern is that, you know, these lending products are not a good option for the working Hoosiers, the low-income folks, and those who don't have a voice that are represented by the coalition.
House Bill 1319 is authored by Republican District 81 Representative Martin Carbaugh.
The City of Bloomington's Volunteer Network is accepting nominations for the annual Be More Award, which celebrate the public service of community members. WFHB's Jonah Chester brings us that report.
The City of Bloomington Volunteer Network is currently accepting nominations for its annual Be More Awards. The nominations will be accepted until February 2, 2018. 10 volunteers will be awarded this year. The winners will receive a $500 donation to the organization which they volunteer with.
There's an overall excellence category. We call it Be More Bloomington. There's a category for groups. We call it Be More Collaborative. One for arts and culture, Be More Creative. One for people that serve on boards or committees or in advocacy roles that we call Be More Phenomenal. A college student or student group, Be More Involved. A child or teenage volunteer that's 17 or under, Be More Energized. Somebody that volunteers in the area of education or literacy, Be More Knowledgeable. Someone who volunteers in the sustainability, the environmental sector, environmental sustainability, that's Be More Sustainable. Animal welfare is Be More Compassionate. In the area of health, wellness, recreation, or fitness is Be More Healthy. And a lifelong volunteer, Be More Dedicated.
That was Elizabeth Savage, Executive Director of the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network.
The website's bloomingtonvolunteernetwork.org, and people can contact me ahead of time that are considering submitting at 812-349-3472 or volunteer at bloomington.in.gov. I can field questions about how they might proceed if they have any questions.
Winners will be announced at the Be More Awards celebration at the Buskirk Chumley Theater. The ceremony will take place on Tuesday, March 27th at 7 p.m. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
A new countywide food and beverage tax kicks in this Thursday. The 1% tax is being applied to hot foods and foods comprised of two or more ingredients that are sold as a single item. Though county officials passed the tax into law in December, some still have concerns about its effect on low and fixed income individuals. County Councilmember Marty Hawk is especially concerned about the effect the tax will have on seniors.
Many of them eat out because they feel like it's cheaper than trying to go to the grocery store and prepare a meal. Perhaps they're living in a one-person household. And it's no longer as convenient for them to try to prepare a meal at home. And not only that, it's better socially for our seniors to be able to interact with others as well. So many of them eat out, but it certainly is not that they're eating out in fine dining places. And many of them order the smaller meals, less expensive meals. So does this mean then that perhaps they'll not order that cup of coffee or maybe they'll have only a sandwich rather than having what they would call a plate lunch? So,
Councilmember Jeff McKim says it's difficult to measure the long-term effect the tax will have on fixed and low-income individuals, but he says there are options.
The example that keeps getting brought up is rotisserie chicken. You know, the hot rotisserie chicken in a grocery store is considered a prepared food, and so it's susceptible to sales tax. So right now, people who buy it pay 7%, they'll pay 8%. But for that exact same item at Kroger's, you can get the exact same rotisserie chicken, except cold, already cooked, but cold, exact same chicken with a different barcode, and it's not taxable at all. So, you know, there's options for things like that. You can choose the the lower priced item and not only save the 1% food and beverage, but actually save the sales tax.
The county adopted the tax to help pay for expanding the Bloomington-Monroe County Convention Center. The expansion is currently estimated to cost $72 million and would include a new Embassy Suites hotel. However, the cost of the hotel is expected to be carried by a private hotel developer. The food and beverage tax ordinance allows for a portion of the proceeds to be funneled to special projects.
In the agreement signed by both the letter of intent signed by the city and the county, specifies that the city will pledge all of its money, all of its revenues in food and beverage towards the convention center expansion, and that the county is permitted to pledge its revenues towards other projects that fit within the law, which is basically tourism and economic development projects outside of the city. And so the amount, like I said, we won't know until we start generating some collections. And then there's also another wrinkle in that the statute requires a 7-person advisory commission that has to agree with any of those expenditures. So, and that commission hasn't even fully been formed yet. That commission includes a county commissioner, a county councilor, the mayor, a city councilor, and 3 owners of businesses that are subject to the food and beverage tax. So they would have to agree on any expenditure.
Hawk says it's worrying 3 seats are appointees and not filled by elected representatives of the people. Furthermore, she says there is nothing in statute that would help officials settle a tie. McKim acknowledges Hawk's concern, but says he's confident the officials will come to consensus on the appointees. As for funneling food and beverage tax revenue into special projects, both Hawk and McKim say there are no such projects on the table currently, but both say parks and trail projects would be likely candidates if there were money left over. In the meantime, they say they'll be happy to see the tax succeed at what it was designed to do, fund the convention center expansion.
Proposed hate crime legislation has stalled in the state Senate. Senate Bill 418 was scheduled to be heard this morning in the Senate Committee on Corrections and Criminal Law. The Associated Press reports the committee chair declined to take a vote on the bill because committee members couldn't agree on its wording. 2 other bills addressing hate crimes have been referred to the committee but have not yet been scheduled for review. Indiana is one of 5 states without any law against crimes motivated by bias. The other 4 states are Arkansas, Georgia, South Carolina, and Wyoming. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Support for WFHB also comes from the Uptown Cafe, established in 1976, located at 102 East Kirkwood Avenue, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as wine, beer, spirits, and cocktails. More information is available online at the-uptowncafe.com.
The Monroe County Community School Corporation School Board submitted a letter to Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb's office, as well as to the state legislature last week, condemning a law that would allow the state to take over Muncie and Gary Community School Corporations. The letter, which was signed by all of the MCCSC board members, states, quote, "The MCCSC Board of Trustees stands in strong opposition to House Bill 1315, the bill that allows the state to take over financially distressed school districts, stripping them of their local control and democratic governance. In particular, the recent amendment to that bill, which would allow Ball State University to take complete control of the Muncie Community Schools with no timeline for returning the school corporation to the local control of their community, is of great concern to us. The letter goes on to say, quote, "We stand in support of the people of Muncie, Gary, and whichever district the state legislature may set their sights on next. We demand that the legislature amend HB 1315 to allow the voices of administrators, teachers, citizens, and elected community school board members remain an integral part of the democratic process and the public accountability inherent in true public education," unquote. MCCSC school board member Kathy Fuentes-Rohr was instrumental in drafting the letter to the governor and the legislature. She spoke with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about House Bill 1315.
Can you tell me a little bit about what's the background of House Bill 1315 and what would this end up doing?
Well, the background is last legislative session there was a law put into place, and I can't remember the number of it right now, but it was at first geared toward Gary, who were in terrible financial distress. Their public school system was $145 million. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but enormous amount of debt in their school district. And to the surprise of Muncie, who were struggling with some problems in their local community around their superintendent and their board and the use of a $10 million bond, and they had their own debt. I think it was Representative Tim Brown, I'm quite certain, who is a chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, put Muncie in the bill. And it was a shock to their legislators, I believe. It was a shock to their whole community. But anyway, that passed, and they all had this emergency manager position kind of put in to try to help them take control and fix their finances. This session, they are at it again through 1315, and poor Muncie was surprised yet again when Representative Brown gave an amendment to give complete control of their school district over to Ball State.
Just in terms of background, how does a school corporation end up getting into $140-plus million worth of debt? Is that an exception, or is that something that would be relatively commonplace for school districts in the state?
Well, I can only say as someone who's been paying attention to public education policy that we've had a huge problem in the economic health of our city areas, and I am originally from Michigan. So my concern is affected by the lens that I'm looking at the situation, which is in Michigan, our governor gave emergency manager status over entire cities and communities, not just their school districts, and it was to the detriment of their people. When you put somebody in charge of financing or in charge of the finances, and in Michigan's case, it was just a business person, then there's a cost to how you cut costs, and especially when you don't have public accountability and you have complete control. And in Flint, for example, children ended up drinking poison. So I think it's a real concern when you lose democratic control and democratic process. My understanding from my friends in Muncie, and I don't have any friends in Gary, but my understanding in Muncie is that they were pretty satisfied, or at least a lot of people that I spoke with were satisfied with the person who was the emergency manager, and there was a timeline with which the community was going to be able to get control. And I thought they also had, like, their elected board members. I don't know exactly how they played in there. But this bill, 1315, takes away Muncie's elected board, school board, and I think just completely diminishes the role of the board in Gary, where they only have meetings twice a year, so I don't think they have any control.
And have you heard anything from Ball State about this? I would imagine that they're not looking to displace or take over that school district.
Well, they are. The people who were in that meeting, from what we know, from what's been publicly stated, is the president of Ball State University, and I guess the Representative Brown of the Ways and Means Committee and maybe some others from the Ways and Means Committee. I actually don't know who in the legislature was in conversation with the president. And now Ball State's president has been apologizing for the lack of community involvement at that initial conversation, for the you know, their representative, Sue Arrington, for example, didn't know anything about it. I gave a talk in Muncie last Saturday for the Indiana Coalition for Public Education, and I talked about public policy in general, educational policy, that is, in Indiana, and basically talked about this. There are effects that happen when you decide to open up this marketplace of schools in the name of school choice, and you start diverting funding and resources from public schools to charter schools and voucher schools and some money over to homeschooling. And as we divert all this funding, these public school systems are getting hurt, the schools that were already hurt by, you know, a downturn in the economy, loss of manufacturing as in Detroit or Gary, then you don't have that tax base. You don't have the – when you have the money following the child, the money goes right on out with the child. And if you look at the situation in Muncie, for example, I was looking at their numbers since we started this really aggressive educational policy of school choice in 2011. The demographic of the kids, of the students in their school district has become increasingly people of color. And they have kids living in their school district who are transferring to other public school districts surrounding Muncie or I think voucher schools and such. And it looks to me, or it would appear, and somebody would have to do a study on it, it looks to me like our state policy and our state is funding white flight.
And Kathy, can you tell me why would MCCSC think about getting involved in something that affects Muncie Community School Districts and Gary Community School Districts?
Well, the Indiana School Boards Association has put an alert out and a call to action to all school districts to speak up against this bill, because this takes away the community's democratic process and representation by taking away their elected school board. And as I said in my letter, the public schools, what makes public schools public is the accountability to the public through a democratically elected school board. These are members of your community, within your community, that you are in intimate relation with by seeing them in the grocery store and seeing them in the street. I mean, this is all people who are accountable to the voters. And once you take away that control, you also take away the transparency, and people who are appointed are accountable to those they are appointed by. And so it's a concern. I think it should be a concern for all of us that once you start losing democracy and the state decides to take that away, how is that going to come back? I mean, what Muncie's asking for is a timeline. They want to know that they will actually regain their local control. And so the school board association and we as school board members are very concerned about retaining that local control. And it's important that you speak out against it, because someone else's school district could be next.
Kathy, any additional comments or anything you think that our listeners in South Central Indiana should know, either about House Bill 1315 or about this letter that was written?
This bill might be being heard by this House right now as you and I speak. I don't know when it's going to hit the House, the full House floor. But I would encourage anybody in South Central Indiana to speak up about this. This is like almost any of our situations, like when they started vouchers or started really pushing charter schools. Most people were not paying attention because they thought, well, that's just an Indianapolis problem or, you know, an inner city problem. It's not a problem for me. But as we see this funding increasingly getting spread thin between these different systems of education, and public schools having a harder and harder time trying to make ends meet in areas surrounding us and across the state, then people are starting to recognize that actually, even if I don't have a school that I can take a voucher to, the voucher program taking something like, I don't know, I think $146 million or so away from public schools is going to affect the whole, and therefore will affect us.
That was MCCSC School Board member Kathy Fuentes-Rower speaking with WFHB's Wes Martin. Fuentes-Rower and the six other members of the school board submitted a letter to the Indiana legislature condemning the move by the state to take control of Muncie and Gary Community School Corporations.
Coming up next, it's the first episode of WFHB's Bicentennial Journal, taking a look at the past 200 years of Monroe County, the city of Bloomington, Indiana University, and Southern Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
Hello, this is my Monroe County story. My name is Alan Dunn. My pioneer forebears were Austin Seward and his wife, Jane Irvin Seward. They were my great-great-great-grandparents who came to Bloomington in 1821. Austin was born in Tidewater, Virginia in 1787 and moved with his family to Madison County, Kentucky when he was six. Upon the death of his father, the family felt hard times and he was apprenticed at age 12 to a blacksmith and then a tool edge maker. After his apprenticeship, he set up shop and became well-regarded for his skills. He was then, at 19, able to marry then 17-year-old Jane Irvin. She was the daughter of Jeanette Brewster Irvin, one of the three Colonial Revolutionary War Patriot sisters who emigrated with their husbands to Monroe County from Kentucky to settle, and whose graves can be found in Dunn Cemetery on the IU campus. After visiting and seeing the opportunity in the newly established community, Jane and Austin relocated to Bloomington, where they set up home and shop on the southwest corner of what is now 7th and Walnut. Austin found immediate success as his skills were vital in Monroe County. He was more than a blacksmith. He was also a gunsmith and an edge toolmaker. This meant he could fashion scythes, knives, sickles, shears, augers, etc., but most importantly, he could make steel-edged axes. In the wilderness, which Monroe County was then, an axe was the most important tool a settler could have, and Seward was truly renowned for the quality of tool he could make. As famous as he was for his axes, he was even more renowned as a gunmaker. He constructed the whole weapon, lock, stock, and barrel. Their quality were unsurpassed. As Monroe County grew and his family grew, the business also grew, and his sons and their sons joined him in his work. In the 1840s, the company expanded to do foundry work so they could fashion plows and other cast iron tools. Iron ore came at first from Stanford and then from Owen County, and the power first from men working the bellows, then horses, and then they built their own steam engines to use and sell. They produced implements and tools, but also artistic items like decorative fencing and the cast iron fountain seen in Third Street Park today. Probably Seward's best-known claim to fame is his creation of the fish on the courthouse. Made of gilded copper, it was commissioned by the county in the 1840s. It's been atop the courthouses ever since. Austin Seward was active in his community. He founded and led the first Bloomington community band and played in it alongside his sons. He was active in his church and kept a room in his home open and available to traveling clergy. He donated to the needs of the city. Notably, when the state university burned, he gave money to the effort that rebuilt the school and ultimately saved IU from relocation outside of Bloomington. Aside from sending two sons to battle, he and the city contributed to the Civil War effort by taking donated brass from candlesticks, hoop skirts, and the like, melting them down to allow Seward to fashion a 12-pound brass cannon that was tested and sent to battle. The company also manufactured over 50 tons of shot and bombs for the war effort. The business continued to evolve and grow with the community, and Seward's son Williamson B. and grandson William Henry Seward carried on the shop and foundry after Austin's death in 1872. They provided machines, implements, and tools that made it possible for the limestone business and others to flourish. In 1909, both W.B. and W.H. Seward died, and the business was taken over by my grandfather, Fred Allen Seward. He was joined by his younger brother, Austin, as a partner after his service in Battery B in France during World War II. What must be highlighted and never undervalued when relating our family story is the strength and contributions of our mothers and grandmothers. From the pioneer times, when Jane Seward bore and raised nine children, through to the present, these women were just as active in the community and their church as their husbands, serving in many organizations, as my mother did, for example, on the local Council of Women, when it was charged with owning and operating Bloomington Hospital. in the book The New Purchase, written in 1843 by Brainerd Hall, who was the original rector of the Indiana Seminary, a chapter is devoted to Austin Seward, where he is given the honorific name Volcanus Allhart. In it, he's described by the author as, and I quote, "He was a Virginian by birth, by trade a blacksmith, by nature a gentleman, and by grace a Christian."
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin and Jonah Chester, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch and Joyce Poling with help from Julie Thomas. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music was produced by Danny Graff, Ben Lumstein, and Scott Schmadke. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB's news programming online at wfhb.org. Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as congressional Republicans used budget negotiations to try and force through their anti-immigrant agenda, hundreds of thousands of women took to the streets in a show of resistance to the Trump administration. Protesters highlighted a range of threats to women's human rights and well-being. Central among those is the assault on abortion access. As we